Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'm thrilled to welcome back to the program today Paul Dixon. Hello, Paul.
Good to hear your voice, Vic.
Paul, it must be Friday because you got a new book out. I'm just kidding.
There you go.
Paul, you put out a lot of books, and I'm really pleased that you do that because you keep me hopping, you keep me busy, and this latest one is Authorisms, Words Wrought by Writers. How did you come up with the idea for this one?
I've always been fascinated by the fact that certain writers, either because of the time they live in or their own creativity, create words that become part of the language. And I think that's sort of the more abstract idea. The idea I've wrestled with for a long time is trying to figure out how many words, for example, did Shakespeare actually create? How many words did Milton create? And some of them are very obvious that they created. I mean, Milton creates the word pandemonium. He needs a place for all the devils and demons, sort of their hometown. And pandemonium is their hometown. And it's also Milton who comes up with the phrase, all hell broke loose. So I've also been intrigued by that. I've also been intrigued by somebody like Orwell, George Orwell, who had an ability to come up with terms like doublethink all the terms of Big Brother, the whole terms Brave New World. I mean, sorry, 1984. So it's also, and I was stumbling there for a second. I was thinking about Brave New World, which of course is a phrase that was invented by Shakespeare, coined by Shakespeare, and then is used by Aldous Huxley. So the utopians, the dystopians, the whole business of language, and of course by language I mean when we first hear a word, we now have a way to sort of visualize that whole thing. So when Shakespeare creates the word anchovy to cover sort of a certain kind of fish, borrowing some more concepts from Portuguese, we all of a sudden know what an anchovy is because it has a name, and in our minds, of course, we get the taste of the anchovy, which Billy Crystal once said was eating an anchovy was like eating an eyebrow. I always like that.
Paul Dixon joins us. Paul, there's so many words and phrases and expressions that have come down to us that we use frequently in everyday parlance. And then there are all the ones that just didn't catch on. And Shakespeare or whoever it was that we credit as being Shakespeare, there's some dispute about that, I understand, came up with so many, but a lot of them didn't catch on. And the really fun thing about your book is we have all these expressions like all hell broke loose that did catch on. And then we have all these other ones that for whatever reason did not. And those are hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorites is it's Grand Falloon. Grand Falloon. And it's what Kurt Vonnegut created. And it's for any large amorphous organization without real identity. And he said examples were the Communist Party, the Daughters of the American Revolution, the General Electric Company, the International Order of Odd Fellows. Are all grand saloons. And so that's a nice one that never really took off. I even have a couple of my own that I put in there, that one of which actually took off, which is demonym, one that I created. And it really is a word for the word you use to describe somebody coming from a certain place. Like somebody from Liverpool is a Liverpudlian. Somebody from Chicago is a Chicagoan, but those actual nouns of identity, which aren't necessarily exactly the same as the name of the place. For example, somebody from Indiana is known universally as a Hoosier. So I created a name for that, and it's now, if you Google it, you'll get a couple, many thousands of hits on that word demonym, demonym, but. And it's from Deimos, for place, and then Nym, NYM, for name. But the dictionaries haven't picked it up yet, so I'm still waiting for that's sort of the baptism or the pedigree. Uh-huh. When you get in the dictionary, you've made it with a word.
Well, in the case of someone like Shakespeare, who is way ahead of everybody else as far as creating words and expressions that we still use. A lot of these were things that were probably commonly known because his audience had to recognize
right.
a word like leapfrog, but no one had ever written them down before him.
That's right, and that's one of the reasons. I mean, I've seen estimates. The sort of established estimate for Shakespeare is 1,700 new words, and they range up to 10,000, which is impossible because his total vocabulary is about 17,000. That was the total number of words that Shakespeare used in all of his plays, assuming that it is just the one man. But a lot of them are. I mean, he comes up with fireworks instead of pyrotechnics, and you have a feeling that that's he may have heard that in among the people that he in the theater and stuff. So with all of these writers, there's this difference between coined and collected. And one of the big things about Mark Twain has been credited with large numbers of words. And somebody actually wrote to him in the 19th century, who was still alive. They said, Mark Twain, well, you've invented all these words. And said, Mark Twain wrote back. He said, no, these are words I heard. All the words, he said, I went out to the mining camps of Nevada and California, and I was on the river in the Mississippi, and I picked up words like bonanza and strike it rich, and I picked up the vocabulary of the mines and the people working the river and the people working in the mines. And he said, those aren't my words, they aren't my creations, but there are still people writing, learned, scholarly things saying that Twain was a great creator of language. And when, in fact, a lot of these guys were probably just like Shakespeare. Because if they didn't know what leapfrog was, and he uses it metaphorically, this audience, which is not all well-educated people, it's a group of people out for an evening's entertainment, they wouldn't know what the heck he was talking about.
A group of people, a lot of whom probably could not even write.
Right.
My guest is Paul Dixon. His new book is Authorisms, Words Wrought by Writers, a good tongue twister there in the title. And Paul is not only my favorite lexicographer, he's also my favorite writer on baseball. So I was astonished, Paul, to discover that the first person to use the term baseball in a book was Jane Austen. That's amazing.
We really don't know. It was in Northanger Abbey, which was written in 1817. And we really don't know. Or it's published in 1870. We really don't know what she was alluding to. Although she talks about the children, the boys going out to play baseball, hyphenated, and the girls playing, staying in the house or something. And there, we found, I point this out in the book, there was a, may have been an earlier use journalistically, but she was the first one to throw it into literature. She was the one who sort of brought it about. And there were bat and ball games in England at that time. And there were bases is a very much a English term in terms of games. And even at that time, in a horse race, early on in that century, a home run in a horse race was what in America we call the home stretch on a race course, with horses. So, again, Jane Austen gets the credit for baseball. And the other one on my cover, of course, I give Shakespeare, I love the word bedazzled because that was when he... There's evidence that he actually did make that one up because that was sort of one of the ones that he my favorites and I have we've got Mark Twain on the cover for hard boiled because that was one of he took that word hard boiled and took it from eggs or cabbage or anything else you would hard boil over to meaning a toughness a hard boiled private eye kind of in that use. But again, the fun of it is just sort of tracing some of these stories back.
I think if I had to choose my favorite historical wordsmith, it would probably be, well, to use your word demonym, it would probably be your fellow Marylander, H.L. Mencken. I love some of the things he came up with. He came up with the term Bible Belt, and I think my all-time favorite, which you also include in your book, is his word, which didn't catch on, but I still love it, the boobwazie.
Oh, yeah. And Ecdysiast for a strip teaser.
Uh-huh.
That's another one of his. The one I enjoy the most because it really affected the way I was thinking is there's an entry in the book, which I'll blow the story, but I'll do it backwards. But when a certain coffee company was getting going on the West Coast, the guys who started the company decided they were going to call the company a Pequod. Mm-hmm. And one of the early investors, one of the main investors in the company, said, wait a second, we don't want to have a name of a coffee company or coffee shops with the name P in it, with a Pequod. It just didn't sound right for coffee. And somebody said, well, where'd you get that name? And he said, well, it came from Moby Dick. And he said, well, give me another name for Moby Dick. And the guy said, what about Starbucks? He was the first mate. And of course, they renamed Pequod, and it became Starbucks. And so every time I see a Starbucks coffee shop, I think of Pequod.
And don't you have a lot of Moby Dick establishments around your area
for some reason? Yes, there's Moby, but there are a whole bunch of them, and they're all such mixed metaphors. But my favorite is Moby Dick House of Kebabs.
I love it.
And I'm one of these people who drives. And I see things that make me laugh, and every time, and all the years I've driven by Moby Dick House of Kebabs, which is within 2 miles of my house, I smile, you know, grateful that there's such a name out there.
Paul Dixon joins us. His new book is Authorisms, Words Wrought by Writers. He joins us by telephone from Maryland. And another wordsmith was someone I associate with Baltimore, and that's Edgar Allan Poe, and he came up with the word hysteria.
Yeah.
I never knew that.
Yeah, that was his, and the other was X, as in X, crossing something out, you know, Xing it out, X. He was the first, I mean, that was another one of his. So it's fun. I just, you know, to me, there are just so many interesting things that just came out of these different people, and I'm trying to, you know, and even something like Banana Republic, which is another one of my favorites, was O. Henry.
Mm-hmm.
Came up that Herb Cain, the writer.
Beatnik,
yeah. And it was basically a steal from the Sputnik had just gone out, the Sputnik satellite, and everything was given that Nick ending. Co-ed is another, I'm just jumping to a couple of my favorites, but co-ed, I love co-ed because it's Louise M.A. Alcott.
Hmm.
And we don't know where it came from. In Joe's Boys, one of her novels, she says, never liked co-ed. He just didn't like eating with girls at school. He liked to eat with the boys. Never liked co-ed. And so that one is, you know, lived well into the 20th century. There are a lot of wonderful Dickens things. One of my favorite ones for Dickens, though, is doormat.
Hmm.
He uses it in Great Expectations, not as a physical doormat, but as a metaphor for person who other people's will wipe their boots on. So, and freelance I love because I've been a freelance writer, and that comes from Sir Walter Scott in Ivanhoe. The idea that there really was a freelance. It was a knight who, you know, fought for the person with the mercenary who fought for the largest fee.
You also make the point that Shakespeare was very good at turning nouns into verbs and shifting the language around. And as we go through your new book, Authorisms, we see word origins of words like Twitter. Did you Twitter something? Google?
Yep.
Did you Google something? Yahoo? Well, you don't Yahoo something, or maybe you do, but there's no Facebook. The most ubiquitous of all, you don't Facebook somebody, at least not yet.
Right, but there is, that's right, but we do have friend.
Right.
Yes, and friending, and that is Shakespeare, Hamlet, Act 1, Scene 5. And what so poor a man Hamlet, as Hamlet is may do to express his love and friending to you. So there you have friending first in Shakespeare and Hamlet.
Goes way back.
Yeah, yeah.
Paul Dixon joins us, and Paul coined the term demonym. You also came up with the expression word. What do you mean by that?
And word is a reduplicated term, and there's a very elaborate Latin name for it in English. I can't even remember. It's reduplicative something or other. It's about, you know, 28 syllables. But word is just for those times when you want to say, Indian versus Indian, or grass versus grass, or book, or, you know, I just read this book. Is it a real book? Or is it a book, or is it a, you know, meaning, is it some other form of book? So, but you, it's a way of sort of reemphasizing what something is by saying the same word over. So grass is probably the most common, as opposed to, you know, marijuana versus that which covers your front yard.
Or in some states, both.
That's right. That's right. It does say, but so I just made up the word for that, and that one actually ends up in the Oxford Companion to English Literature or something. They use that instead of the more complicated, you know, official name for those things, where you just use the same word over for a second time.
Well, I was delighted to learn that the first time the word nerd appeared in print was in 1950, according to your book, and it was brought to us by none other than Dr. Seuss. And he had that classic line, quote, "And then just to show them, I'll sail to Katru and bring back an it-kutch, a preep and a prue, a nurkle, a nerd, and seersucker, too."
Yeah.
I love that.
I know, and now seersucker is in the back seat of the car and nerd is in the front, right?
Well, I was happy to see also that you have created these words and you have been a guest on this program. And a couple of other former guests have also created words according to your book. One, Dave Barry, created the term stud muffin.
Isn't that a nice one?
I like that. And then there's Calvin Trillin. I love this story where you talk about how he went out and tried to get an expression adopted, and it didn't work out so well. Sabbath gas bags.
And I now, of course, once some of these things, once even though they didn't get picked up, once you hear Sabbath the gas bags, of course, are the people, the so-called pundits who drone on the Sunday talk show. And, I mean, you know, in the old days, when you and I were kids, you know, it was Sunday was, you know, church and music and, you know, getting ready for the football game in the afternoon and all this stuff. And we're maybe going to the baseball game. And now it's these guys on television with ties on just going on insufferably forever.
And I can see how Trillin would be sensitive to that. But if you know Calvin Trillin, you know this is just the kind of thing he delights in. Yet he is credited with a couple of words. One is wonky,
yes,
and the other is the term buffalo chicken wing. And knowing his delight at cuisine, I can understand how he was the one that brought that into our common usage.
I mean, that's a great example too of somebody who, you know, has a great ear for this stuff. The other one was an interesting one. Every once in a while, some writer will actually go out of their way to make up a word. The most interesting one to me is Mailer, Norman Mailer's factoid.
Hmm.
And Mailer created it for, it was a pejorative. He created it in 1973 for a piece of information that becomes accepted as fact, although it is not actually true. Or alternatively, an invented fact believed to be true because it appears in print. And so it was really meant to mean a falsehood, or not a falsehood, but a something that just wasn't true, even though somebody said it was fact. And but it's sort of become the means a small fact.
Mm.
Here's a factoid for you, you know, and then the person will then tell you something that's true, or some survey or something, which I doubt half of those things are true anyhow.
Paul Dixon joins us. He's written extensively about a lot of things, and particularly about words. His new book is Authorisms, Words Wrought by Writers. When you check to see about some of these words that you tried to introduce into English, you did discover that you were given credit for a word that we can't say on the radio that came out of your collection of synonyms for the word drunk.
Yes.
I thought this was very impressive, Paul.
I know. But I actually, the fact is that these are in the Oxford English Dictionary, which is now online, and it used to be like 20 huge volumes, and now I'm in there for these words I actually didn't create. But, you know, maybe the I'll give some of them back to Shakespeare.
Some of these words that haven't caught on, I think, should. And in particular, there's a term in here that I have been guilty of, and I think it's a great word, but you never hear it. It was created in 1975, and it's roomscanitis, an affliction of some partygoers that makes their eyes flit about looking for someone more interesting or less dull than you to talk to. And we've all seen it. You're standing there at the party, and you're talking to somebody, and they keep looking over to the other corner of the room like, gee, there's someone over there I'd much rather talk to than Vic.
Well, and the great story about that fact, the guy who invented that term is John Corcoran, who's a very funny writer and spent most of his life, I think he just retired, as a television personality in Los Angeles. And John was writing a piece for the Washingtonian magazine, and he was writing about Washington cocktail parties. Mm. And in it, he said one of the great afflictions of the Washington cocktail party was roomscanitis. And it was disease that permeated the room. And that was, these were people, you'd be talking to somebody, and all of a sudden they're looking over your shoulders as if for somebody more important or powerful than you were. And, of course, for John, it was like everybody he talked to. But I do it myself. Now, I'll go to some event or something, and I'll say, look, it looks like I'm doing room scan. I have a case of room scanitis, but I just want to see if my wife has arrived yet, you know, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
So I now use it as if everybody else knows what it means. And they say, what did you just say? And I said, room scanitis. It's this disease that people in Washington get where they can't be content to look you in the eye and not worry about who's behind you.
I was very surprised to discover that the word scientist is actually a fairly new word.
Yeah, I mean, those are a couple of things that really were interesting to me. And, of course, even when when you date something, it changes your whole approach to how you look at that thing. I'll give you an example from something else. I mean, if a word doesn't appear until a certain point, one of the words that I was intrigued with is the word, people at Merriam-Webster have been unable to put the word gunslinger back before about 1950.
Oh, really?
And the reason was it was created for television.
Oh.
And it was just a word that just fit into the early Westerns. And another one was bounty hunter, meaning somebody who actually went out for a reward money. And those were words which were created, so we think of these as terms of the Old West, but in fact they were really terms of the Western movie in the Western on television. And a lot of the words that we associate with the Western are from Owen Wister's The Virginian, head 'em off at the pass, things like that. But we create our own mythology. I mean, a lot of the words of the Middle Ages that we think were part of the Middle Ages were created by Sir Walter Scott in Ivanhoe and his novel. And Scott had a huge influence on the language. He came up with a lot of things that he sort of cobbled out of his own imagination or out of some Scottish dialect. And I live in it's funny, I live in a town where Scott, every street in the town is named after Scott, or place in Scott.
Oh, really?
So I'm on Kenilworth, and we have a Waverly Drive and all these places that are named after Scott. And one thing I didn't put in the book, which I in the early version, was that Mark Twain, if you read Life of the Mississippi, is convinced that Scott's novels about chivalry and knights and the round table and the whole business were a partial cause of the Civil War. And there's a huge essay within there. He said that Scott had romanticized death and dying and the nobility. And even Scott's, use of the term clan, the Klansman, all of those things go back to Scott's sort of romantic idea of the lost cause and dying for that cause. And it's a really interesting dichotomy. So one of the reasons that Twain, one of the things he's lampooning in Connecticut Yankee, which Twain himself thought was his greatest novel, is Scott. He's making fun of this whole system of, death, but death with dignity through, hand-to-hand combat and all this stuff.
Uh-huh. Well, your town, then, the original Platts must have been laid out by some Walter Scott nut.
Oh yeah, he was a very authoritative man who laid out the town. He was a vice president of the B&O Railroad named Garrett, and he was He didn't. He actually tried to run the town in the early days, in the 1880s, when it was founded, as sort of a feudal state where he wanted certain rules obeyed too, and the town eventually left him for things like indoor plumbing.
Hmm.
He thought indoor plumbing was something effete and not very proper for a small town.
Ah, and thus Garrett Park, Maryland. I think my favorite word, or one of my favorites in your whole book, Authorisms, is one that was coined by C.S. Lewis, and I wish it was in more common use. It's verbicide. I just like the way it sounds.
Isn't that nice?
That's a beautiful word.
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Well, the term for the killing of a word, or the willful distortion or deprecation of the original meaning. The killing of a word, just the distortion of that word.
One that comes up on this program frequently is in your book, and that is the word whodunit.
Oh, yeah, isn't that nice? Yeah, and that was invented by a reviewer in a review whose name is Donald Gordon, who was just writing about early murder mysteries, and he came up with one word, whodunit. And another one which is sort of fits that whole same business is murder mongress, a female writer of murder stories, which was a term invented by Ogden Nash to describe Agatha Christie in a poem, and it was fashioned to rhyme with murder mongers, to rhyme with Library of Congress. Murder mongers.
Good old Ogden Nash. Well, Paul, it's always a treat to have you on the program. How many more books are you going to put out this year?
That's it for this year. I'm working now on a biography of Leo DeRocher.
Oh, is that public knowledge now?
Well, it's getting there. I've still got to get a contract, but I'm sorry. And I just signed to do a little book on contraband cocktails. It's a little book about all the cocktails and the whole concept of the cocktail party invented during Prohibition.
Oh,
that
wow.
That was when the cocktail came of age, because so many people in America were scofflaws. And scofflaw was a term invented in a contest by the Boston Herald. Boston Herald wanted a name for those Americans who were willfully disobeying federal law, which said they couldn't drink liquor or alcoholic beverages. And the winner of the contest came up with the word scofflaw. Well, in my new book, I'll actually have a drink named the scofflaw, which was invented during that period.
Well, we'll look forward to those, Paul. Thanks, as always, for your time.
Thanks, Vic.
You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. Our guest has been Paul Dixon. His new book, Authorisms, Words Wrought by Writers. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. Next week, we'll head out to Hollywood to talk to longtime actress Swoosie Kurtz. Her memoir, Part Swan, Part Goose. She's done it all. Big screen, Broadway, television. Swoosie in the Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.